Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So it's a great privilege to be invited to give a talk on this Memorial Day after a festival of remembrance. And we have guests from an introductory retreat and guests who have come to this festival, so welcome to you all. I thought about what I could start talking about on this occasion, and the first thought that came to mind was gratitude. Gratitude for how fortunate I am to have lived really my whole life in very peaceful times. Grateful that we've all been able to do that. And, of course, I appreciate that if you spend much time looking at the TV or the internet, there's all sorts of atrocities that we hear about and violence and aggression. So it may sound strange to say that we live in peaceful times, but for me, as you can hear from my accent, I'm English, and I have the experiences of my father and grandfather in particular to think about. And actually neither of them spoke very much about their wartime experiences, but I know that for my father, he was in the Merchant Navy during the war, and at one point in 1941, the ship he was on was hit amidships by a battleship in the middle of the English Channel, and his smaller ship was cut straight in half, and half sank with loss of life. The half that he was on floated, and it floated back to England. If it had floated to France, he probably would have spent the rest of the war in a prisoner of war camp. But, you know, that was clearly a horrendous experience for him. My grandfather was in the Royal South African Navy, and one thing that we found out many, many years after was that he was involved, he was a ship's captain, so on his orders, depth charges were being dropped into the sea to attack Japanese submarines off the coast of South Africa. And that was top secret because South Africa was technically not involved in the war. So war puts people in very difficult moral positions. And I haven't had to deal with any of that. There's been no likelihood of my being called up to fight. I haven't had to do national service. It's probably true for most of us. And that's something to be really grateful for. For myself, when I was growing up as a child, I used to play on little playgrounds in southwest London. It's a very quiet, residential, suburban part of London. And it never occurred to me when I was small why there were these little playgrounds in the midst of streets. You'd have a row of houses, and then you'd have a little playground, and then the row of houses would continue again. When I got to being a teenager, I worked it out. These were actually old bomb sites from the war. They'd been tidied up, you know, playground equipment had been put there, and that's where the kids used to play. What would happen during the war was that German bombers would come to bomb East London, where the docks and the factories were, and on cloudy nights they couldn't see their targets. You know, the technology that we have today didn't exist. So they'd fly over London, and on the way back they'd come over West London. And if they calculated that they didn't have enough fuel to get back because of the headwinds, they would jettison their payload of bombs over a residential area. So, you know, without any warning, in the morning there would be a house gone and a family gone. So when you realize that as a child, somehow war becomes a little bit closer to you, to me, even though I've never been involved in it. So yes, gratitude. One of the first things that we're traditionally taught in Buddhism is a very simple thing. It's to put your shoes straight. You take your shoes off to go into the Buddha hall here, into other rooms in the monastery, and rather than just kind of kicking them off into a corner somewhere, We place them deliberately and we express gratitude for our shoes. It may seem a very small thing. Here at Shasta Abbey, if you walk around the grounds without shoes on, you'll realize pretty quickly that, you know, shoes are quite handy. Pine needles, pine cones, resin, ants, all sorts of stuff. Yes, it's a small thing, and if we learn this, you know, when we're young or when we come new to Buddhism, it's an easy enough thing to do. But we can take it in two ways. We can take this as an instruction that we should obey because a teacher that we respect has taught us this. But if we only do that, what we might misunderstand is the symbolism that putting your shoes straight is pointing to. What matters is the gratitude. Whether or not we put our shoes straight, this isn't important. You know, you see somebody else's shoes kicked over there, don't worry about it, that's not the point. The point is the gratitude. If we haven't heard of the value of gratitude, you know, we might think it's not necessary. We might think in a way that's entitled, and this attitude of entitlement is something that is more common these days. We might think that we don't need to be grateful. We might think, you know, just with our shoes, I bought these shoes, I earned the money, I paid my taxes, I can do what I like with my shoes. And of course, that's quite true. If you extend that sense of entitlement, we might even get to a point where we think to ourselves, I paid my taxes, and that pays soldiers' wages. I didn't force anybody to join up, so if they get killed, it's their problem. Now, we'd never say such a thing, but, you know, you can think these things. We can think these things to ourselves. And this, I think, comes from not recognizing the value of gratitude. The true value of gratitude for us as meditators is that it opens the heart. Metaphorically speaking, it relaxes this gristle that separates us from other people, from other things, from those around us. It separates us from everything that we are part of. So gratitude dissolves, if you like, the skin, flesh, bone and marrow of the small, scared being who thinks that he or she has to take on the world and win in order to succeed in life, or who fears that they're going to lose somehow and are doomed to fail. Gratitude opens the heart and frees us from these fears. Now, leaving aside this sense of entitlement, even if we do understand the value of gratitude and we take that on board, it's still worth asking what the limit of our gratitude is. Is our gratitude limited to the things that we want? So, you know, we're grateful if we win the lottery. Yeah, I can be grateful for that. Or I'm grateful for all of the things that are in the way that I want them to be. Can we extend our gratitude to include all of the things that we come across in our experience of life? Because not all of those things that we come across in life are going to be exactly how we want them to be. So, can we see the value of our disappointments? Can we see the value of regrets? Can we accept them, and can we actually be grateful for the opportunity to have felt them? Disappointment and regret are very subtle feelings. They don't kind of come up and, you know, slap you around the face. Fear, desire, contempt, these are quite big feelings. But disappointment, it can just kind of creep up on you. The older we get, the more experience of life that we've had, the more opportunities there are for things to just not go the way we hoped and expected them to go. And we can then judge aspects of our life as successful or unsuccessful. There's value in being able to recognize what we feel and to be open to it I mean, really with our hands open, just to accept things as they are. The alternative is to want our life only to contain good feelings. And, you know, anyone who wants that, good luck. I mean, that is... I don't know. But honestly, good luck. There's a famous saying in Zen, all acceptance is the key to the gateless gate. And this is how to see the value of all of these aspects of our life that may be uncomfortable. When we are able, and we are able, to practice all acceptance, this is actually the manifestation of truly understanding the value of gratitude. So meditation can seem like a very private practice, particularly on an introductory retreat. It's been mostly quiet. We haven't spoken much socially with the people that we've been around. Sure, we've been around a lot of people, but our focus has been quite inwards, of course. And so meditation can seem like a very private practice. We work with silence, and we often work in solitude. So it's worth stopping and thinking just for a little bit, what a privilege it is that we have to be able to do that, to be able to practice Buddhism, meditation freely in our country, in our society. It's worth looking a little at the conditions that let us practice. You know, we have a monastery here. You don't have to be in the monastery to practice, but it's certainly helpful to have these wonderful facilities. But there are other conditions that allow us to practice. We have the right, we have the real freedom to assemble freely, freedom of assembly, freedom of association. That's something to take very for granted when you're born and you grow up in a country that's free. Do we live in a repressive state? No, we don't. But there are some places in the world where, for instance, it's not actually permitted to teach meditation. And that's quite hard to imagine. I know from the monastery where I normally live, Throstlehold Buddhist Abbey in northern England, that when we have in the past sent out paper copies of the journal of the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives, there have been people to whom we have had to send these small journals under plain cover, because we can't put, you know, a stamp saying where it's coming from on the cover, because the people who are going to receive this live in a place, not in Britain, but outside Britain, where it could be difficult for them, it could create difficulties for them if other people know that they're Buddhist or that they practice meditation. So there is a freedom really to be grateful for, and it's worth asking ourselves, are we grateful in fact for the freedoms that we enjoy, or do we take them for granted? Asking that is important, because there's a clue here for taking meditation more deeply. One of the ways of talking about meditation is to talk about the four foundations of mindfulness. And this is a doctrinal thing. It has a name in Sanskrit, which I'll probably mispronounce. I think it's Kartur Smriti Upasthana. So there you go, four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness is a big thing nowadays. You hear about it all over the place. I don't know for myself, when mindfulness is taught in a secular context, whether the foundations of mindfulness are spoken about. I kind of hope they are, because it would really help with mindfulness. But just so that we know, the four foundations of mindfulness are mindfulness of thoughts or ideas, mindfulness of feelings or emotions, mindfulness of the body or physical sensations. The fourth one is slightly strange. It's mindfulness of things, mindfulness of dharmas with a small d, and I like to think of it as mindfulness of conditions or circumstances. So the conditions that we enjoy, that give us freedom to practice, these are things that we can actually be mindful of. This is part of mindfulness practice. And to take the four foundations of mindfulness seriously is to help set up the conditions necessary for the realization of enlightenment. So there's very much a connection actually between this private personal practice and the conditions at large that we enjoy in this county, in this state, in this country, in this world. So I've talked a little about gratitude, and on this Memorial Day, I would also like to talk a bit about courage. To serve this country requires courage, broadly speaking. Orders are given, and for a person in the military, it's expected that orders will be followed. It's expected that orders will be obeyed, even if the reason behind them isn't stated. In my life, I've worked with one or two ex-soldiers who, you know, I've just come across in one situation or another, and you know, this is a big thing for troops in the army, in the navy, in any of the armed forces. You receive orders, they receive orders. The reasons aren't necessarily stated. We don't know what we're getting ourselves into, and it isn't our job, it isn't their job to question what the order is or to try and work out whether the order's the right order, whether it's all going to be a disaster, whether it's just wrong. And it's so tempting for us to think, well, ooh, is this right, is this wrong? Hang on a sec, I need more information. You know, tell me and I'll think about it and then I'll get back to you. And it's not that. It's not that. For soldiers, you just obey. And of course, that requires courage. That does require courage. Even if you're not having to go into a war zone, I mean, it still takes courage. And it strikes me that it also takes courage to practice meditation. I'll come back to this. One of the most moving experiences for me as a monk was when I was helping lead an introductory retreat at Throstlehold Buddhist Abbey a year or two ago. You know, it's a real privilege to me that Buddhism and meditation is able to attract a very broad range of people, young and old, black and white, male and female, gentle and hard. So there was a guy on this retreat, and, you know, I look at him, and this is a hard guy, okay? This is a strong man. And he was very quiet, kept himself to himself. We went through the introductory retreat. We did all of the usual things that those of you on an introductory retreat this weekend have done. And we got to the final tea, and we had talked about right livelihood, and we had mentioned that what matters with right livelihood are the intentions that we bring to our job. And yes, if we find ourselves working as a butcher and we want to practice meditation, then we may have to look at how we are living our lives. But the fact that you are a butcher does not mean that you cannot practice meditation. That's where you start from. You know, where you take meditation and where that takes you in your life afterwards. Okay, but for the time being, you start where you are. At the end of this introductory retreat, this guy, this hard-looking fellow, said, I didn't think I was going to get through this weekend. I'm a serving soldier. And I was, you know, I was very moved to think that a serving soldier could make it through an introductory retreat. And I was very grateful for that. And so, yes, as Buddhists, generally speaking, all we have to do is to sit still, to learn how to sit still in the midst of the passions and emotions that arise and that we experience. Soldiers have to serve in the face of those emotions. Ultimately, they have to serve in the face of the ways that other people's unrestrained emotions play out. And that's why I say it that's why I say that it takes courage to serve this country. You can ultimately be facing people who are caught up in anger and hatred and delusion and who have no interest in doing anything about that. I think generally when soldiers go into battle, they're not going into battle against armies of meditators. That would be a different thing. So for us, when we sit, no one's pointing a gun at us. It's a choice that we make. It's a free choice. Yet, to actually sit still, when our habitual ways of responding to the world are demanding that we don't sit still, that actually can feel like a death too. I'm talking about sitting still in formal sitting meditation. When we sit still, when we sit even for 20 minutes, we are inviting thoughts and feelings and memories to surface. And it's easy to be caught up in those thoughts and feelings and memories, to be run around by them, even to the extent where we think, I can't do this anymore, I just got to get up and do something else. It takes effort to sit still, even when we are sitting still. But to bring meditation into our ordinary daily lives, at work, with our families, that involves letting go of these habits sometimes. And these habits can present themselves really when we least expect them to. I had an experience picking someone up from the airport a few days ago. I had an errand to do on the way, and I parked the car in a large parking lot, lots of other cars. It's all very nicely marked out, of course. There's white lines. It's very clear where you park. And I did it all right. I parked inside the white lines, no problem. But I may have parked a little bit close to the car next to me, but they were quite close to the line. And it just put it the other way around. Let's say I get back to my car and someone's parked really close to me and I can't get in the driver's door. I can open the door, I can unlock the other doors, but then I've got to go around the car, I've got to get in the passenger seat, slide across the driver's seat. And for some people, that can make you really angry. I'm getting better with this, but and then let's say the other driver comes along and they let themselves into the car. For some people, you have to work quite hard not to express your anger with this person. And you can feel very justified in saying, hey, fellow, why do you have to park so close to my car? Can't you see? Maybe it's appropriate. Probably not. It's a silly little example, but anger, fear, strong emotions can arise, as I say, when you least expect them to. And if we're used to just simply responding from our habits, we can get caught up in behavior that causes an argument. Fisticuffs in the car park, it does happen, and it goes worse than that. But to let go of that urging to say something when you are right there, you can do it. You can do it. And meditation shows us how we can do it, because we find the stillness in sitting meditation and we can return to that stillness. And it's really important to do that. Even so, it can feel as though a little bit of us is dying when you are at that moment where you can let go. You still have to do it. And, that's why I say it takes courage to practice meditation too. So, we can actually, if we're willing, learn from the example of the courage of those who follow orders for a living, even if that is at the cost of their own lives. In a sense, we can follow orders too. In our case, the orders that we follow are the teachings of the Buddha. However, these are teachings which ultimately we give to ourselves. Even though we may have heard them from teachers, nonetheless, when it comes down to it, the teachings of the Buddha are teachings that we give to ourselves because we take refuge in them. We choose to take refuge in them. Buddhism is always a choice. Every morning, those of you who were on the introductory retreat will have noticed that we say the Kesa verse. We rededicate ourselves to practice afresh every day. No one can force us to, and we can't even force ourselves to. We can't say, well, you know, I made this commitment a few months ago, so that's it, I'm a Buddhist. Yes, great, and there's good things that flow from doing that. And we have to rededicate ourselves to training, to practice every day, actually every moment. When I think of courage, I think of the life of the Buddha. In the story, there's a young man who is raised in a palace by his father, who perhaps fears the prophecy that he has heard when his son was born, that he would either become a great monarch, or else he'd become a saint. And the king of Siddhartha, the father of Siddhartha, the king, wanted his son to take over from him. So he made sure that he grew up in a palace in order to protect him from anything that might make him become a saint. And of course it didn't work out that way. But for Siddhartha, the prince, as a young man, he's growing up in luxury in a palace. And yet he had a sense that there is something more here, something that maybe he even felt like he was being kept from truth. But he still had to make the effort to leave the palace. He had to escape from the palace, almost as though it was a prison. It would have been really easy for him not to bother doing that, just to think, well, yes, I'd like to find the truth, but, oh, well, it's kind of comfortable here, and I've got lots of girlfriends, so... or even to have escaped the prison of the palace and find the jungle, and it's pretty hard out there, and yeah, okay, maybe I made a mistake, I'll just go back, I'm sure they'll have me back. So it took courage for him to do what he did. And again, in the story of the Buddha, it took courage actually for Siddhartha's manservant, Channa, to help him leave. The story goes that Channa prepared a horse for Siddhartha, and he left in the middle of the night. And in fact, Channa swapped clothes with the young prince so that he could blend in more. And then that he actually went back to the palace to explain what had happened. And I hear this story, and to me, I wonder what happened to Channa after he got back to the palace. I mean, you know, the king's a powerful man. He's got one son, and this guy's just helped his son leave the palace. He's going to be pretty upset, I would have thought. So to me, Channa might have expected to be severely punished, but still he goes back. And I think there's courage there. I think there's a great sacrifice that the Buddha made, and Channa too. This brings me on to the last part of the talk, which is another thought that I had in connection with Memorial Day, and that is to do with humility. When we consider the sacrifice that other people are willing to make, and you know, the sacrifice in war that people make is a pretty complete and ultimate one. Anyone who can make that sacrifice, which is the sacrifice to follow instructions, be it the instructions and the orders of a commanding officer or the instructions that we take on board as the teaching of Buddhism. To do that, we have to let go. We have to let go of all the objections that arise in our mind. When we're practicing meditation, there's all sorts of reasons why we shouldn't do this. There's all sorts of reasons why the instructions that other Sangha members are offering us, it's wrong. You know, they haven't quite understood. And the objections ultimately stem to this sense that I'm doing it right and everybody else would be better off if they just did it my way. For a confident person, it's like that. For someone who lacks confidence, it's like, everybody knows how to do things and I don't know how to do anything. that's another objection that arises in our mind. Sometimes we have to trust that we do know what we're doing, and we have to be able and willing to let go of these objections that arise in our experience of mind. These objections can also be emotional ones. We can feel them in our gut. I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. The objection can be a physical objection. In my experience, being a monk is quite a physical thing. There's a lot of physical involvement in meditation. There's sometimes, particularly when I started sitting, I'd get pain in my back. I was 21 when I started. I'd had several years as a teenager, typical sort of teenage indolence, lying in bed and doing whatever pleased me. And then I get to be a bit older, and life's hard. My body's a little bit soft, and I come to practice meditation. I can't do it. It hurts. It hurts my legs. It hurts my back. I was weak. And making the effort to actually sit still in meditation benefited me physically, but it was hard, and there were objections there in my body. Body doubt, doubting that I'm physically capable of doing this. Now, obviously, as we get older, our bodies change, and we can't do everything that we could. But still, sometimes we can ask a little bit more of ourselves than we are perhaps comfortable. Our ability to let go of objections, to let go of greed, hatred, and delusion, fear, doubt, desire, our ability to let go of that comes from humility. Humility is deeply involved. All of the things that prevent us from realizing the truth of the Buddha's teaching, these need humility to allow us to let go of them. Our ability to let go of these things comes from humility. And we may judge ourselves and think, well, I'm not really a very humble person. I'm very arrogant, or I'm very confident. It's right that I'm confident. I've worked hard in my life to be the confident person that I am. And so humility, well, I can't really do that. Actually, we are never far from humility, because the kind of humility I'm talking about is the humility to be able to see the mistakes and the miscalculations that we've made in the past in our lives. Again, as we get older, we've accumulated a whole bunch more mistakes. And not to be too judgmental about the things that we've done, but we know that there are some miscalculations that have had consequences for ourselves and for other people. Often it's the people that we love the most. It's our children, our brothers and sisters, our broader family, our colleagues. If you've done something at work and someone else has got the blame for it, ultimately, those sorts of miscalculations and mistakes are there in our past. Often there's nothing we can actually do about them. We can't go back and change them. We cannot change the past. But we can accept them, and we can accept them with gratitude. And we can express the wish, if only in our own heart, to do better next time. Sometimes in Buddhism this is described as contrition and conversion. We use the word sangha to describe this. Seeing the mistakes that we've made, acknowledging them with humility, and vowing to ourselves to make a better go at things next time. The real sacrifice that we make if we do take refuge in the Buddha and in the Dharma and in the Sangha is the sacrifice of letting go of the idea of a separate self that we've become attached to. And I'm talking about the idea that somehow my achievements in life, my abilities, my successes, my happy memories constitute me. I'm talking about letting go of the idea that my failures in life, my sorrows, my self-loathing are me, that all of these somehow constitute a me that is separate from others and needs to be either protected or denigrated. Actually, none of these things are me. None of these things are truly me. To truly see what me is to look with the deepest humility, to see what's left when all of our attachments are allowed to disperse. And this dispersal is something that we can experience sitting on our cushion, on our bench, on our chair, in just one meditation period. If we are willing to let go with humility, with courage and with gratitude, then we can see what is left. And it's not nothing. It's not a void of there's just nothing there. We haven't lost everything. We've gained something, in fact. But we've not gained something that can be grasped and owned, but there is something there. It's as though we're left spiritually naked. Naked in the sense that we're not wrapped up anymore in layers of insulation of our own opinions and habits, which we've built up over a lifetime, or indeed over the course of many, many lifetimes. This is what we tend to do. We have habits and opinions and thoughts and beliefs, and all of this we wrap ourselves in to protect ourselves, because there is a fear in there deeply. So, in meditation, let all this insulation drop off, let it fall away. Allow yourself to be vulnerable, naked in that sense. This is the consummation of meditation. And we are naked, metaphorically, as naked, if you like, as the body of a soldier who was willing to give up everything in the pursuit of their duty. And so it's right and proper that we never forget the sacrifice of those who died in service for this country, the sacrifice that they were willing to make. And we can take that as something which can guide and inspire those of us whose own sacrifice, in fact, is made in the furnace of meditation and spiritual practice. And that's where I'd like to end the talk. Thank you.